This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm with Abby Bennington. How are you, Abby?
I'm very good, thank you, Chris.
Great stuff. Abby's one of our tutors here. I'm the head tutor here at 3050. We're both certified WST educators.
Yes, we are.
You got yours just recently and I did mine quite a few years ago.
Well, it was a couple of years ago now. Yeah.
And we both got our diplomas actually as well. Yeah. So, although you're very recent and I'm very old diploma. And you run your own business, ABV Tastings.
I do, yeah.
Very big on Instagram.
I try. ABV Tastings on Instagram for anyone who's interested.
And don't forget 3050 on Instagram.
Oh, yes,
as well.
Definitely. And definitely 3050. Yeah.
Okay, what we want to talk about today is we're going to talk about the winemaking and the grape varieties for red winemaking in Bordeaux. And we said in an earlier video podcast that there's four key grape varieties in Bordeaux, three really key grape varieties and Petit Verdot. WST often call them principal grape varieties and other grape varieties. And they are, the key ones are Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and Cabernet Franc. And then Petit Verdot is a lesser grape variety, but it's still an important grape variety there. And do you want to tell us what those different grape varieties give to a blend?
Yes. So often Cabernet is considered the grape varietal which adds best to the wine in terms of creating a wine that can age well or have complexity. But it isn't the one that's mostly grown here. Cabernet Sauvignon is, however, really, really important. It takes a lot of ripening. It's tricky in this maritime climate, this wet climate, to ripen fully. So even in the greatest years, Cabernet Sauvignon can also struggle to ripen fully. It is a thick-skinned grape variety, heavily pigmented. It is also a grape variety that has high acidity, which is great for age-worthy if done in balance with the rest of the wine. And also a wine that is high in tannins, that dry, grippy sensation. That
and also colour, because you get a lot of colour and
highly
tannins
pigmented
from those thick skins.
Yes.
And that, even though it's not really talked about much, that thick skin helps in a maritime climate. It gives it a bit of disease resistance.
Yes, exactly. Very good point, actually, because a thick skin means it's not as delicate to all the kind of issues of disease pressure that you can get in this area.
Yeah, okay. And then Cabernet Franc, what does that give to a blend?
It's a variety, as we've seen in Loire, so it can ripen in this maritime climate. Some people talk about aromatics. Some people talk about a finesse. Or I hate to say, be sexist, but often say it adds a feminine context to the wine. It's really, really important in as part of the blend.
Yeah. It also it can be a little bit herby and stalky if it's a little bit underripe. And whilst it grows in Saint-Emilion quite well, it also grows quite well on the gravel and grave because it likes those dry feet. A lot of grape varieties don't like wet feet. Cabernet Franc in particular likes to have dry feet, so growing in gravel, it really responds to that. And also Saint-Emilion, because the limestone we talked about earlier drains really well as well.
Absolutely.
Whereas the clay tends to be heavy, soggy, not the best for Cabernet
Franc.
Cool.
It's a cool soil and it's a wet soil, yeah. Which Merlot likes, which brings us on to Merlot. So Merlot is the largest... The backbone, the greater production of those red grapes within the region are made from Merlot. And Merlot is a great varietal. It's slightly out of fashion now, I would say, wouldn't you say, Chris?
Only if you're American. Merlot.
Yeah.
Sideways is a lot to answer for.
It does, actually. On that, Merlot was actually pulled up in a lot of areas in California as a result of that film. But anyway, I digress. So Merlot is, I always try to think about it as a varietal that kind of straddles the Cabernet Sauvignon and the Cabernet Franc. And it's somewhere, it's neither red fruit nor black fruit. It's more like the blue fruit. So it's the blueberries, those kind of...
I always think of it as plummy.
Well, it is. I mean, that's how it's described, but I try and think about it. It's a great example of a high quality Merlot coming out of Bordeaux. For me, it just reeks of blueberries.
Okay. I always smell it and go, plums. Even though I've eaten loads of plums and they never quite smell of
you need
Merlot.
To be specific. Red plums or black plums, Chris?
Or yellow plums. There's all sorts of plums out there. But yeah, you have to be particular, don't you? You've got to be red or black. What about Petit Verdot? Petit Verdot gives a floral vibrance to it. It gives colour and it gives a bit of tannin structure as well. But it's always 4-5% in a blend. It's not very...
Yes, it's usually less than, as you say, 5%. Often 3% is that kind of sweet spot for Petit Verdot. Petit Verdot is a grape variety that's highly pigmented again. It's thick, it's skinned, it takes a lot of ripening. That's why it's only ever really used in small quantities. However, in the wider blend, it's great for giving aromatic lift and adds to complexity to the overall wine.
Cool. Right, let's talk about how they make red Bordeaux. And probably the first thing is we talked about maritime climate. We've talked about that maritime climate, disease, pressure, all that sort of thing. So once you've harvested the grapes, the first thing a premium producer will do anyway is sorting tables. They'll spend a lot of time making sure that the grapes that go into the vat are good quality grapes.
I think we could even go before that. I think there's a lot of the higher quality grape producers will be looking at those grapes in the vineyard. So even before they get into the winery, those selections, their pre-selections have been done.
If they're hand harvesting.
Yes, if they're hand harvested. But as you say, sorting tables, using either human beings picking through the grapes to make sure that there aren't any rotten grapes or underripe grapes or discolored grapes or even any little things that they call mog, don't they? Materials other than grapes.
Yeah.
They're all sorted out. The higher producers will use optical sorting,
yeah.
Which is a machine that actually can pick out the grapes which aren't either overripe or underripe or in any way affected by disease or mold. So that's really, really key before we even get into the winemaking process.
And then once you've got the grapes, you've got to get the stems off, because particularly if it's Cabernet Sauvignon never has ripe stems. And if you have any of those stems in your blend, it's going to create bitter, astringent tannins. You know, if you go to Burgundy, you'll often see people in Burgundy will chuck stems in because Pinot Noir can have ripe stems and it can give tannins to the higher end wines. But you've got to de-stem, particularly Cabernet Sauvignon. And in fact, everything's de-stemmed, isn't it?
Yes, it is de-stemmed. You're absolutely right. Cabernet Sauvignon has those stems that never fully ripen, even when the grapes themselves are ripened fully. And as a result, putting that into a blend is a really, really tricky thing to do, because as you say, you get those bitter, herby, green flavours, which are not desirable in the resulting wine.
Okay, and then obviously we're making a red wine here, so we've got to crush it. Because why do you have to crush reds?
Well, we have to crush reds because we want to release the juice, and we also want to allow the juice to pick up the colour from the skin.
And tannins.
And flavour. And flavour.
Yeah, there's quite a bit to pick up. So you've got to crush them. So that's a compulsory. There's no mucking around there. Into a tank. Always stainless steel, pretty much, isn't it?
Yes.
I don't think there's... I have been in Bordeaux and I've seen people use rotating barrels, rotary barrels.
I have seen that in some... I've seen that in Fronsac. There's a few areas that do it. Some of the smaller producers do it, but that is quite labour intensive.
Yeah. And also you've got to have a rotating barrel because during alcoholic fermentation, the carbon dioxide tends to lift the skins to the top. And therefore, you don't have the juice in contact with the skins. So that becomes a problem. So by having it in a rotating barrel, you can keep the skins moving through the wine. But that's very unusual. Usually, it's in a tank. Open top, closed top. Well, you've got to get the cap down underneath it, don't you? So you've got to be able to get into that cap somehow.
Yes. So the cap, that's the skins that naturally float to the top of the tank, which is where all the, as I say, the color, the pigment, the tannins are housed. You really want to keep that in contact with the actual, the juices and the must and the fermentation, as well. So what they have to do is you have to find some way to get that integrated back with the juice. And that can be done in a number of ways, can't it? One way is, I always say, it's like a punching down, they call it. It's like using a big shower head and you're punching down, you're pushing that cap down back into contact with the juice. So that's one way of doing it, and that's pretty hard work. Another way you can do it is you've got like a fireman's hose that comes from the bottom of the tank, and that pours the ferment back onto the top of the cap, and that also pushes it down.
That's a bit like a percolated coffee.
That's true, actually. Yeah,
because you've got the juice or the fermenting juice percolating through the skins all the time.
Yep.
So that's one way of doing it. What else we got?
There's a rotary fermenter, isn't there, as well? And that's a turning blade, which also continually turns within the tank, and that allows the juice to continue its contact with the skins.
If you're making a premium wine, you're looking for a lot of skin contact, because you're looking, often the premium wines, you want them to age. So for them to age, you need tannin structure. And to get tannin structure, you need a lot of skin contact. So you're going to see some sort of cap work in a premium wine. In a more entry-level wine, it's going to be a lot less because you want softer, easier drinking wine. So that cap work would be a lot less. Things that affect the extraction are things like temperature. The warmer the fermentation, the more you extract it. And also alcohol is a solvent for tannins in particular. So as the fermentation continues towards the end of the fermentation, you're going to get a lot more extraction towards the end than you would at the beginning.
Yeah, that alcohol, it almost dissolves. So I always talk about it, as you say, like a solvent, it dissolving, and it just extracts those additional tannins, which you just don't get earlier on in the ferment.
In fact, if you're making a soft, easy drinking style of wine in Bordeaux, you might do what's called a pre-fermentation maceration or a cold soak. And that's where you crush the juice, you leave them in the tank, but you keep the temperature nice and cold so fermentation doesn't start. And what that does is it extracts color and flavor, but there's no alcohol there, so you don't extract a lot of tannins. So if you're trying to make a softer, easy drinking style of Bordeaux wine, you might do a pre-fermentation, very little cap work, and certainly no post-fermentation maceration. Because after alcoholic fermentation, you get into your post-fermentation maceration. But let's talk about temperature. We said that the warmer the temperature, the more extraction. Post-fermentation maceration, again, some people do post-fermentation maceration, particularly if you want to extract lots of tannins. Remember, you've got lots of alcohol here in the completed wine, so it's really good for extracting. Some people believe that if you do a post-fermentation maceration, you'll get a slightly smoother tannin structure in the wines. I'm no winemaker, so I'm not sure, but people talk about it being a way of getting lots of tannins, but also smoother tannins from post-fermentation maceration. Before you put the wines into the barrel, you need to get it out of the fermentation tank. And you've done your post-fermentation maceration. And the first thing you can take out, you can just drain the juice away. And that's going to be the smoothest, softest wine. But then the skins that are left, there's still a lot of wine in that. So you want to get it out. So you shovel, they literally shovel it into a press and they press it. And the harder they press it, the more they're going to rip the pips and the skins, and you're going to get more astringency coming out of it. So what you'll find is you'll get different press fractions, if you like. And the free run juice is always the best quality, the softest, cleanest. And then the last little bit where you squeeze the bejeebus out of it, that can be the harshest. But that still gives you blending opportunities. And some of the really harsh stuff, if you're a premium producer, you might sell it on the open market to other producers. And then aging.
Aging.
Yeah, maturation, which for cheap entry-level Bordeaux doesn't really exist.
Straight to bottle.
Straight to bottle, or at least in tank for a while just to calm down after post-fermentation and then into bottle. And then the more expensive, the more new oak they use.
Yes. Oh, gosh, that's and new French oak as well.
Yeah, French oak.
So why French oak? Well, we are in France, but French oak is really important, obviously, in Bordeaux and for aging. So what does new and old oak mean? So new oak means that the wine is aged in a barrel at 225 litres. Let's be clear about that.
Yeah, it's a barrique. It's a Bordeaux, which is different to Burgundy barrels.
Yes, it is.
Similar
slightly
size.
Slightly smaller, 3 litres smaller. And these barrels... Oh, God, I could talk about barrels all day, so I'm going to have to pricey this. But essentially, a new oak will impart a completely different set of flavors to old oak. Old oak is purely there for micro-oxygenation, either through the slats in the actual oak barrels themselves or through the pores of the oak.
Or the cap as well.
Or the cap, that's right, the bung. Or new oak will impart certainly French oak will impart flavors like vanilla, cloves, and cedar.
Cedar, for me, I see a lot of Cabernet Sauvignon and cedar. You know, when I taste a reasonably decent Haute Médoc or a Passat Leon or something with a bit of Cabernet Sauvignon, I'm always going cedar, cedar, cedar. That seems to be the real, for me, Cabernet Sauvignon, black currants and cedar. Bang. That's me, Bordeaux.
Yeah, absolutely. And those flavors and aromas are obviously more intensified the more new oak you use. Now, it's probable that most producers will age some of their wine in old oak for that micro-oxygenation, and they will also age some of their wine in new oak, and they will blend later on between the two or the number of barrels in order to kind of even out those flavors and aroma profiles.
Yeah. So, as Abby said, the barrels lose flavor the more they use them. So sometimes I'll have a 1-year-old barrel or a 2-year-old barrel or a new barrel. And it'll be a blend of barrels typically, because if you just use all new barrels, it can be quite overwhelming, particularly if the fruit doesn't have the concentration. Whereas the more premium the wine, the more concentrated the fruit, the more oak they can take.
Absolutely. Interestingly, if anyone is interested, these barrels are obviously handmade and produced, and they used to be around 1,000 euros a barrel. That's going up. And increasingly, producers are just renting those barrels. So they will keep them for a number of years, and then when they no longer impart any aromas or flavours, they will send them back to the tannolery or on lease and get the new ones in.
What do the guys, the coopers, do when they get the barrel back? Do they reshave it?
They can reshave it. They either pass it on to a secondary market, but it's slightly more expensive from the producer's point of view because they have to pay a slight premium because it's like a higher purchase they get. But for them, they're not stuck with a load of barrels that they can't use or have to sell.
Firewood. Oak. Pot plants. Lots of pot plants. Okay. So we've made the wine. We've aged it in barrels, and now we've got all these different barrels, and each barrel will age the wine slightly differently. You know, no two barrels are alike. Some have got more toasting, some have got less toasting, some, they're all just slightly different, aren't they? Even if you get the same barrel from the same cooper, from the same forest, made exactly the same way, same wine from the same tank goes into them, after a year or so, different wines.
Absolutely. And just to be clear on this, that toasting a barrel means that when the coopers are making the barrel, it's almost like an upside, a flat top tent, and they pop those barrels before it's curved back into that kind of traditional barrel shape. They pop that barrel over an open flame, and that will toast the barrel, which gives it those additional flavors that we were talking about. And the degree each chateau or each producer will want to have their barrel either less or more toasted, and depending on the wine style they're trying to create. So as you say, yes, it will vary from batch to batch, from winemaker to winemaker.
You might use it as a blending option. And that's where, after you've aged the wine in barrels, that's the next big thing, isn't it? It's the blending, because you've got all these different grape varieties, different locations perhaps, different winemaking techniques, different yeast strains they could have used, different fermentation temperatures, different barrels. You've got a real cornucopia of different
smorgasbord.
Options. A smorgasbord.
A smorgasbord of opportunities. Options. Yeah, absolutely. That is born out of necessity as much as anything. As we're saying, this is a climate that is maritime. Some varietals may not, you may be a bad year, you may not have ripened your Cabernet Sauvignon fully or as well as you'd like. So you may want to end up using more Merlot in the blend, or more Cabernet Franc. So yes, the Bordeaux blend, which is known globally. I mean, you know, California prides itself on its Bordeaux blends, even though they're within their own rights, they are a world-class wines. Bordeaux blend is a key phrase that you'll see everywhere, and that's the reason why.
Mm. And if you think about what's going on, I always think of like the Merlot Cabernet Sauvignon trade-off. As Cabernet Sauvignon is quite an edgy wine. It's got high acidity. It's got high tannins. It's got quite sharp blackcurranty flavors, hopefully. And I think of it like a Formula One racing car with all those edges of acidity and tannins. Whereas Merlot, I think of it as like a soft Cadillac, you know, it's all soft and spongy. The acidity's not as high, the tannins aren't as high. It's just a bit richer and fuller in the mouth. And what you're really blending is you're blending the power of the Formula One racing car, the Formula One Cabernet Sauvignon, and the width and the roundness from the Merlot. And they're your two main grape varieties. And that gives you that sort of power and guts up the center, but also the mouth fillingness and the body that you need from the Merlot. And then you chuck in a little bit of Petit Verdot for a little bit of exotic spice, maybe a little bit of Cabernet Franc as well. And there's your classic Bordeaux blend.
Yeah, I like to think about it. I don't want to be super feminine about this, but you could say like the spiky high heels, which look beautiful and are beautiful, but pretty uncomfortable versus your slip-on, your flats.
Oh, okay. So Merlot's...
Your Merlot's, your flats, and your spiky, your Manolo Blahniks. I'm sure everyone's got that. I wish. Your Cabernet Sauvignon. And both are great.
Yeah. I think you need... And then Bordeaux, you need both of them in the blend.
Yes, you do.
To get the wines. Fabulous. And then you'll blend maybe just before maturation in oak, and then you might blend, and you definitely blend afterwards. And some producers will have like their grand vin, the top wine from the chateau, but they might have a second or third wine as well. And depending on the blending options, you might put all your best stuff into your grand vin, or at least the best blend. And then the other wines might go into your secondary or third labels. And that's another way of ensuring that the quality of the top wine stays. Because if you do get a dodgy year, some of the wines that would go into your Grand Vin might be declassified into your second or third label to make sure that even in a dodgy year, your top wine is always superb. And then if the grapes aren't quite up to scratch, you might sell it on the open market to a negociant or something like that.
That's true. But let's not forget that even in a difficult year, the best winemakers can still make great wines.
Yeah. But you may not get as much out of it as in a really good year.
The volume might not be there.
All right then. Cheers. Yeah.